Hello, and welcome to Everything Cookbooks, the podcast for curious writers, readers, and cooks. I'm Molly Stevens, and I'm here today with Kate Leahy, Andrew Nguyen, and Kristen Donnelly. One of our main goals in starting this podcast was to welcome more voices into the conversation. So with that in mind, we thought it'd be fun to dedicate today's episode to answering questions from you, our listeners. To kick things off, let's hear a voice recording that one of our listeners left on the Everything Cookbooks website.
Do most cookbook authors and publishers engage recipe testers to make sure that their recipes work in a home kitchen? And if so, where can I sign up to test all of them? Thank you.
This is such a fun question because I think it's actually like one of the best ways to get involved in cookbooks if you've never done it before. The way to sign up is honestly to reach out to some of your favorite cookbook authors, or if you see somebody who is on Instagram saying like, hey, I'm writing a book, I would just message them and say, hey, do you need any testers? What do you guys think?
Totally. That's how I get them. Initially, on my first book, I went after specific people because I was starting out. I didn't have a track record. And so I would ask my friends and I would just say, oh, you know what? That's sort of like the average home cook. I'd say, that's the average white home cook. I picked an economist for that one. So, you know, you kind of like pick people that you ideally would want to really take your recipes through the paces. And then after that, volunteers are awesome. Sometimes they stay with you and sometimes they don't.
It's such a good experience too, recipe testing. I was just doing some recently and you learn so much about how to write a recipe because the information that's there or not there, and when you really have to do it on such a granular level. But yeah, I think reaching out to some of your favorite authors or anybody you know who might be working on a book.
Right. And I would also look for maybe authors where it is, like Andrea was saying, your first book, you're looking for people. I mean, I wouldn't recommend reaching out to someone like Ina Garten because she's got her crew.
Right.
So reach out to somebody, maybe it's their first or second book and you like their work and you want to help their work become better. I think that's probably the best approach. And you maybe if it's a really good fit, you can kind of grow with that person and become sort of like, always a sounding board for at least a handful of recipes when they're doing a new project.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a good idea. So next up, we have a series of questions that have come to us either through the website or via DMs on our Instagram feed. In a few cases, we've summarized or grouped the questions because several of them deal with the same issue. So Kate, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, this is a fun one. So what's a good reason to start cooking with a scale? To me, scales always mean dieting or baking, neither of which I do. So what am I missing out on?
Oh my God, a scale never lies. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it's like next level accuracy.
And even if you're not writing recipes, I mean, we all talk about using scales in our recipe development because we just want every single, you know, way to measure an ingredient and yields and things like that. But even if you're not using it to write recipes, the accuracy is just, like you said, it never lies. You know, a pound of potatoes is very different than, or might be very different than two large potatoes.
Oh my gosh. It goes back to our whole onion, you know, conversation. What is a medium yellow onion versus a red onion versus an enormous shallot versus a fake shallot, a phony shallot, a wannabe shallot? And when you're calling for a large, you know, onion in your recipe, it's always, what I like to do is I'll say, okay, this is, I'm going to measure these batch of onions and I'm going to see, all right, well, if I'm always using consistently, this onion is roughly 2.5 cups, is roughly 250 grams. I can just be more consistent on my recipe development side. But as a cook, I mean, here's an easy way to use a scale, right? You put a bowl on a scale, you zero out the bowl, and then you put your flour in. And then maybe you need to add sugar into that. Well, you don't have to use a cup. You don't have to get something else dirty. You can just zero out the scale again and put the sugar into the bowl and build from there. So it's just a great way when you start using a scale. You can just cook, as a home cook, you can just cook faster, and especially with baking. So you don't have to get super fussy, but it is a really just nice way. Once you get used to using a scale all the time, it's hard to go back.
In a way, it's quicker. And it also, I think, like the example you just gave, Kate, you dirty less measuring cups for sure. And I don't know, am I right in saying that more and more cookbooks include weights in addition to volume measure? You think you're seeing that more?
I go back and forth. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a certain point. Chef books tend to have a lot more weighted measurements, right? Because they want to be very precise and they're going off of recipes that may come from their restaurants. So they want a certain consistency level and they want outcomes that match theirs. But there's a certain point where things do overly, you know, they come off too fussy. But okay, so this listener says that they neither diet nor bake. So let's say you're just working on the savory side and you're working with animal protein or grains or something like that. You just want to like weigh things. Let's say you're subbing, you know, it says like a 3.5 pound chicken and you don't have a whole chicken, but you got chicken parts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the butcher may have been on or off. And so, you know, you can substitute that way. So it's great for substitutions. And I'm going to say something that's going to sound totally geeky or just freaky. But I do this thing where I'm like, I buy this onion and I think it was a small onion when I was at the store, but I didn't weigh it. And I'm like, was I right? So I'm always kind of like guessing too. I was playing a little game with myself.
Yeah, I do that too. And I like, okay, this is going to be an 8-ounce potato. I know it. And I put it on the scale and sometimes you get it right. You feel so good when you get it right.
Yeah, that's true.
So weird.
Small victories, everybody.
Small victories, yeah.
I was just working on a recipe. It was a fondue recipe and it called for a cup of shredded, one of the varieties of cheese. Yeah. And it also had a weight measure. And I use the weight measure because a cup of shredded cheese, one, I've got to jam it in the cup. And then, you know, like we said before, I've got a dirty measuring cup. But also how hard, how full, how, you know, densely you pack that cheese makes a big difference between how full the cup is, how much cheese there is. So the weight measure could be super helpful for that as well.
Cheese is such a good example, actually, because like basically if somebody calls for a cup of shredded cheese, it's often implying it's already shredded. And to me, like that quality isn't as good. So if you have the weight there, it just makes it easier to know like how much of that block of cheese are you going to then shred yourself.
Yep.
Exactly. And then with things like Parmesan, you know, it depends on how you grate that Parmesan. Like, oh my God, drives me cuckoo.
Like a microplane.
Right.
Shred versus microplane.
Versus a rotary.
Or if you're fortunate to live really near a good Italian store that sells truly freshly grated, because there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we're always saying, oh, it should be freshly grated, but it doesn't mean you can't buy it already done that way. So
true. Right.
And the one last thing I would add for scales is sometimes if you say have a jar of something and you have another jar, you can, if you have an empty jar and a jar that's maybe half full, you can see how much you have in that half full jar by putting the empty jar on, tearing it out, putting the half full jar, and you can kind of get an estimate on what's in that jar, say. I mean, that's kind of more of a geeky thing too, but I do that a lot of times with sourdough starter when I want to know how much is left in the jar. I'll just put an empty mason jar on that and then figure out, oh, I've got 20 grams left of this little tiny bit of sourdough. I'll know how much to feed it. And so that's maybe more of a baking thing. Yeah, scales are really handy for baking, but that's stuff that chefs do all the time with empty containers versus full containers so they can get a gauge on what's in there.
One last thing is you make discoveries.
We clearly think scales are important.
Yeah. Yes, you make, you know, my mother, and people are always telling me this, you know, my mother never measures with a scale. My mother used a scale from like when she was in Vietnam.
Awesome.
And she loves her digital and her old fashioned, you know, analog scale. But anyway, you make discoveries with the scale. For example, you discover that white granulated sugar weighs differently than organic granulated sugar.
Yeah. Okay. One last thing about scales. Andrew, you and I have talked about this, that in the grocery store, they still have those old fashioned hanging, you know,
thank goodness.
Scales. I use
scales. And I think I'm the only person who ever uses them. Most people don't, you know, they're in their way, but I love like, okay, I need, you know, a pound of peppers and just to see, okay, I got 3 in my hand. Is this going to be a pound or is it going to be over? And I get it right. I'm like, yes. They're like, who's the crazy lady? All right.
She must be a recipe developer.
Well, you guys, here's another good one that I really like rack my brain with every single time I write a book. How do you choose the right cookbook title? Something that's going to work, something that's going to sell. help me and also help this listener who's asking the question.
I mean, if you're working with a publisher, you will have help from your publisher for sure. That said, you often want a working title on your proposal. So a title's important.
So what's a working title that Kristen, that you may have had that may have changed along the way?
Let's see. Actually, it's funny. All the titles I've proposed so far have lived, but with Modern Potluck, we did go around and around. It was on my proposal as it was the Modern Potluck. We changed it to just Modern Potluck, which I actually like better. But we did go around and around on that for a little while. Getting the subtitle sometimes is like so important because we ended up with Beautiful Food to Share. That became this like mishmash with the publisher.
I think a lot goes back to what we keep going back to is who's the book for?
Yeah.
Where is it going to be in the marketplace? Are you trying to sell it in bookstores? Are you trying to, you know, sell it at craft fairs? What, you know, figuring out who wants to buy the book, who will buy the book, and then what's going to make that audience be attracted to the book.
Right. So I have an example. So on my sixth book, it was originally titled Elemental Vietnamese. I thought, oh, it's so graceful, you know, and I was, that's my muse and that's my motivation. So I always have a working title that gets my mojo going. And then I started recipe testing. One day, Tina Ulaki, who has this amazing interview with Kristen, she wrote me, she said, Andrea, no, that's just too fancy. You need to come up. Yeah. She said, you need to come up with something that's just speaks to people more, because in that book, there was no Asian market shopping required. So I thought about it and I thought about it. And then I said, Vietnamese food any day.
Oh, so you came up with that subject. That wasn't a back and forth with
no. And they came back with every day. And I said, no, any day, because I don't cook Vietnamese food every day. And I don't expect other people do.
Right.
I just want people to feel like they can make this food anytime they want, just like they would make tacos or burritos or Thai food or Chinese food or Italian food. Right. I want it to be normalized in that manner. So, you know, that's an example of where you're thinking of your audience. You're also thinking about the theme and the nugget that's in the work that you're doing. And the book that I'm working on now, it's mostly about vegetable cooking and Vietnamese food. And the title I came up with was Evergreen Vietnamese. But my editor, Lorena Jones, said, put a hyphen between ever and green, because it's mostly about vegetables. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, we went back and forth and fine-tuned it according to what the content is and the audience. So it's a real balance.
That's a great story.
I feel like there was a working title for the book that you edited with Emily Thelen about Paula Wolfert. I remember talking to Emily as she was working on that, and I can't remember what the working title was, but I was like, I feel like it needs to be like one word that like hits it, you know, that will just, it has a resonance. And I don't remember if in that call we came up with Unforgettable or if she came up with that later or if you all came up with it, but yeah, there are some times where it's like that one word title. And that was one where I was like, that's it. Like, as soon as I saw it, I was like, that's right. It. That's perfect. I love
that. So, Kristen, that was you. Cause I was like, whoa, that we do need to, you know, have something there that just captures the Paula Wolfert's life. And Unforgettable captures her life as well as the situation she was in with Alzheimer's. So, yeah. Some people said, ooh, that's just kind of weird. And we asked Paula, she's like, no, that's fine.
It's these recipes. We want them to be unforgettable. Yeah. It just worked on so many levels. And sometimes I feel like there are those titles that work on many levels. And I still actually get chills thinking about that title and that book because it's such a beautifully done book.
Oh, thank you.
I think titles are one of the hardest things to get right. And I think I would wonder how many books you all think go out into the market with a title that it's fine, but it's just like maybe there just wasn't that perfect title for that book. Sometimes that happens and you just kind of have to run with something. Right. And sometimes maybe that goes back to this. I'm thinking about your story, Molly, about how All About Dinner came about because you were thinking about breakfast and you were thinking about lunch and you ended up cutting that and creating a book that was about dinner and how that helps encapsulate everything. Mm-hmm. But I do think sometimes, especially working as a co-author, you have maybe the subject, you're working with somebody to tell their story, but it's just harder to find that hook that really encapsulates everything they want. And it can take months of brainstorming. So I think anyone who's looking at creating a title that works for them, first think about how someone's going to find your book. Think about, are there Google search terms? And not to say you got to go with search terms for your book, but if you do want to be the book that people, you know, there's one book on this particular topic, you want to make sure there's something in that title that makes people think of that subject. So if you're lost, you can kind of go with that maybe a little bit.
Right. Here it's like two things where it's a book that has to have a hook. It has to have a draw. You know, it has to catch you, but it also has to connect with what the book's about. It can't deliver false promise. So it's a really complicated thing. Like, I don't know, you might all have different process for coming up with book titles. And, you know, if you're working with a traditional publisher, you're working with a sales team. For me, it always involves several long walks or hikes where it's just, you know, brainstorming. Like, you know, I'll come up with a great idea for a book, but it's not my book. You know, it's a great book title, but it's not the book I just wrote or I'm writing. So it has to do both things. It's a great question.
It's a hard one.
Yeah.
And then there are trends. Like sometimes you see trends and then people get sick of trends. Like there's been a trend for a while now where some book titles just, it's like a couple of ingredients, you know, or one ingredient that's really evocative of a type of food. And I actually still love those titles, but I've been with people where they're like, okay, I'm getting sick of this, you know. So that's always interesting to me.
And some books really reflect the author and the personality of that author and the brand that person has. So someone like Carla Lali Music, you know, her recent book is called That Sounds So Good. Mm-hmm. That reflects who Carla is and the kind of food and cooking and the recipe writing that she does and the teaching that she does. So it really depends, you know.
Or Ali Slagle's I Dream of Dinner So You Don't Have To.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like such cheeky, a good title. A little cheeky. I love it.
Have you ever had the experience where a publisher comes to you with a title and you just think, oh God, no, that does not sound. Because I've had that experience where, I mean, it's nobody's fault, but it's like, oh, what do you think of A Chef's Year of Preserving? And it was like, oh, I don't think this is going to work. But then the pressure was on me to think of something that could beat that out. It's workshopping. And sometimes you might have this title idea that you think is just the best. And then if you're working with a publisher, they say, well, so we're still working on the title idea. And you're just like, what about my best idea? And they're just like, that's just not going to work.
Not it. Yeah. There's also the issue of people using the same title for a book that already exists. Basically, you can't own a title. And there's a more recent example that has just come up with a book called Keepers. Smitten Kitchen, Deb Perlman has a new book coming out called Smitten Kitchen Keepers. And then there is another cookbook called Keepers by Kathy Brennan and Caroline Campion.
That came out many years ago, that one.
Many years ago, yep. But it's still in print. So, you know, when things come up like search, that's where there's probably this real conflict.
Yeah. I mean, when Alison Roman's Nothing Fancy came out, I was like, wait. And that one of Diana Kennedy's, if not her first book, one of her first books long time ago was called Nothing Fancy. And it was just sort of like, oh, titles can be reused. I mean, yeah. It's true in film too, right? Don't they reuse titles sometimes?
Oh, right.
True.
With the book about the Chef's Garden, we found out that Fiden was working on a title that they were going to call The Chef's Garden. And the agent was able to work with them to, I think they ended up calling it Garden Chef. The Garden Chef. But that was something where, like, we saw it coming.
Yeah, I think that would be the key to make sure if you are reusing an old title or...
You might not realize it.
You might not realize it.
So
maybe,
yeah.
Maybe it's deliberate and you just think it's a great title and needs to be, you know, revitalized, or you just didn't know. And I think knowing is better than not knowing.
Most definitely. I mean, when you do your comps, you think that you would, you know, do a search title and just...
You might not know your title at that point, though, when you're doing your comps. You might have like the Pass the Fish Sauce as your title, and then you're doing comps on certain. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, that was a. That, you know, I really came up with a very original, and people,
I love
listeners,
it.
I still own it.
There you go. There you go.
So what's the best way to put together a cookbook for my family?
Oh, nice question.
I have a friend who is working on this, and she gathered recipes from all kinds of relatives and tested them and wrote head notes. And it was really cool. I actually don't know what she ended up doing, like how she ended up publishing it. But I know that there are some tools that we have heard about, right, Andrea? Were you just telling me
about
one?
Yeah. You know, someone, Sri, reached out to me on Instagram, and she mentioned a business that she operates called myheirloomproject.co. They have these really cool templates that people can invest in, and then they'll turn around and also make 5 cookbooks. And, you know, price points and paper stock and all that stuff is something that you want to investigate before you invest. And it all depends on how many copies you want. But, you know, I, like, some of my friends have done, you know, small, like, picture books and stuff. Have you guys ever done something like that?
I've used blurb.com to create photo albums, and I know that they have a way that you can create cookbooks. It might even be so you could, like, create them and sell them if you wanted, but if you wanted to just create a cookbook and print 10 for gifts, they make that really easy.
That's great.
Yeah, but you know, when you're putting together a book for your family or your community, by all means, you know, the stuff that we talk about on Everything Cookbooks could apply to what you're doing.
Absolutely.
You don't have to, you know, be thinking about recipe development and all this fancy stuff. It's fancy sounding and it's sort of serious sounding, but it's also not. You can certainly dial it down and apply it to smaller scale projects to make it really polished and practical for your family and your community and friends.
That's funny. I have a friend who did a really sweet book a few years back for sort of her summer community, and it was like a family cookbook, and it was just friends and family, and she's an incredible artist. And so there were all these drawings, and it was a really sweet book. And she's been listening to the podcast, and she texted me the other day and she said, I wish I had known all this. I would have tested the recipes and edited the book, and it would have been, you know, so much better. And she was just so kind of to what you were saying, Andrea, is that you can take some of this stuff and make your family project, you know, just elevate it a little bit. And if you really do want people to follow the recipes, then by all means, test them and edit them.
It's so true. I feel like there's so many community cookbooks where it's literally just like hand in a recipe and it's published, and you can be more careful than that, you know.
So we'll put those links in the show notes, and I'm sure there are many more platforms out there to create family heirloom books and things. Here's an email we received a few weeks ago. My question is about writing a cookbook with recipes that are not in English. In my case, I'm writing an Afghan-American cookbook where some of the recipes are very traditional and others have more of an American hybrid twist. Do I keep dish titles in the native language of Pashto and provide context in English, or simply include English titles?
I've dealt with this a lot.
I'm sure.
I deal with this constantly, sometimes in multiple languages. I would say it depends on who your end user is, but I'm going to tell you this. Times have changed so much that nowadays readers, whether they are, you know, fluent or somewhat knowledgeable about the language and culture that you're writing about, whether or not they expect some of that, the native language to, or the original language to be included, because that's really honoring that culture and that history and that heritage. So I would definitely provide both. And then the other question that a book designer recently posed to me was, do you want the Vietnamese title to come first or after the English title of the recipe?
I was wondering that.
And that's an issue of power. Mm. Who are you going to give that power to? In the past, it would definitely have been like the English would go first and the Vietnamese would go after on a second line, but now you can put them on both lines. Now you can put the Vietnamese above the English. So there are many, many different possibilities. And also, do you have scripted language? Do you have Romanized? Do you have English? It's really up to you as the author to talk with and also to think about and consult with the editor and designer and as to how that can be presented so that it reflects your mission and also honors your heritage and your community.
I often think about the index as well and like how people are going to search for that recipe. And again, I guess this goes to like who is the main reader and will the reader be searching for that recipe more often in the original language or more often in English? I don't necessarily think every single title has to be the same in terms of like, I don't think it has to be consistent. I think if it is, you know, maybe it's using certain flavors, but not even that close to an original or traditional dish.
Yeah. Well, like this listener says, some of them are sort of Americanized hybrids and some are more traditional. And so that might be an instance. Yeah.
Right. There might not be a perfect translation for the Americanized hybrid.
Yes. And that's another term that I find very problematic, frankly, is this term Americanized. It's just food, you guys. I hear this all the time from people. It's like, well, that's not going to be traditional, true Vietnamese food because it's Americanized.
Ah. Nope.
It's made by Vietnamese Americans. It's made in America in this context. It's not Americanized. It's just their food.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wouldn't present it as something that's Americanized because I think that that has a derogatory aspect to it. I'm thinking about the Korean American cookbook that was recently written and released by Eric Kim. And that is food that is about his experience, his lived experience as someone who is of Korean American heritage. I don't find that to be Americanized food. That's just his food.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when appropriate, you can have a translation, you know, if possible, of the food that you're making. But sometimes you just can't, and sometimes you don't want to. And sometimes you can also mix it. So like what's cool about his recipe titles is sometimes he'll have English in there and then a Korean word. So it is very much the way Korean American English is spoken. Mm-hmm. And I think that that reflects the tenor of what he's trying to get across. So for this person who's writing the Afghan American cookbook, you can play with language a lot more nowadays because your reader is much more open-minded.
Yep.
I think that that's sort of the beauty and flexibility that we have to work with nowadays.
And I do think it was maybe 2019 that was a turning point in the conversation about titles, because if you look at cookbooks that came out maybe 2019 and before, there was a lot of that stew or, you know, just things that were very vague titles. And now we're getting to be more specific. And with a book like what this person wants to write, I think it would also be really great way to showcase culture a little bit more by having those words that she would use to describe these recipes. So when I was working on Lavash, one thing that we had to figure out is how to have the recipe written in the Roman alphabet as well as with the Eastern Armenian alphabet. And when we had both titles for the recipes, we also had to have somebody proofread who could read Eastern Armenian. And what we found is there's a big difference between Eastern Armenian and Western Armenian and how you translate that. So just if you're going to have multiple languages in your manuscript, make sure you get it read by multiple people who can find typos, because your publisher's not going to be able to catch those for you. And the a copy editor, even amazing copy editors, it's rare to find them that would also be able to catch those differences in language.
That's a good tip.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the next question. This is a question that we have had so many times. So, and it's a great question because I think we'll keep asking this question for the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 years from now. So how do I write a cookbook without a large social media presence?
It's not so much how you write one, it's how you sell one.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, I should have rephrased.
How do you find that agent? I do think back to what Rika Alanik said about idea, voice, platform. So if you have a really strong idea and a really strong voice, you'll have an easier time with a smaller platform. But if I had an idea that I was just dying to do, and I have a small social media platform, but if I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the book I want to do right now. I can't wait. I would pitch at least 10 different media outlets on stories related to that idea, partially to get proof of concept, but partially to like associate myself with the idea. And I would take whatever form of social media is growing fastest. So right now it's short form video, whether that's TikTok or Instagram, whatever's going to bring you growth. And I would shoot videos related to that topic again, to associate yourself and to grow fast. And then that way you can kind of like work on a proposal and work on that at the same time. So by the time you're ready to pitch your proposal, maybe you actually have that platform. So that's what I would do.
Best answer ever.
Yeah, I got nothing to add. That is smart.
Yeah,
that's a tremendous answer. And it is, you know, strengthening the two things that you do have, making sure your voice and your idea are as strong as possible, and then building that platform any way you can.
Right. And one quick note on that, if you're torn between two ideas, Kristen's answer is a great way to test out both ideas. Maybe if you pitch a story and it becomes a really popular story on whatever site, that could be a hint that the subject also might resonate as a book. And I'm thinking like the book One Bottle Cocktail. That came out of a very popular Serious Eats piece that Maggie Hoffman wrote. And I think that's what gave, you know, maybe she was approached by agents or publishers. I can't remember the trajectory, but that was a hint that, oh, you're onto something. So if you have maybe two subjects that you're torn between, maybe use Kristen's idea and try them both out and see which one resonates the most.
So this brings up a question that we've gotten a few different ways from other listeners about having your ideas stolen if you put them out there. I think that if you associate your name with it and you keep at it, it is your idea. And if someone can steal it from you, it's just not something I spend too much time worrying about.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about it, but you do need to kind of stick your claim in the space as we've been talking about. You know, you need to have your name associated with that subject, with that title, so that when people think of you or they think of your subject, they think of you. It's always coming back to you. It's all about you. It's not about me or we, but you know, this is a question about you.
Right. But I hear that fear of having something original and have it being stolen. And I just feel like if it's truly original, then it really does belong to you. And you're the only one who can tell it the way you're going to tell it.
Exactly.
You can't live in fear of having someone take it. You just have to keep going for it and keep pitching it and keep refining it until you get to where you want to be with it.
Yeah. When my proposal for Modern Potluck was circulating, I heard from a number of publishers, oh, we actually got another proposal about like updating potluck food. And, you know, I had that initial fear. And then I was like, well, I mean, like people love gathering and right. I'm not going to own potlucks. Like maybe I'll be associated with it as well as other person and I'll do it my way and this person will do it their way. And it's all good. Yeah. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I've definitely embraced the idea. It's like 95% is execution.
That's so true. It's been a couple of times, especially when I was really just starting out. It was after A16 came out and then after The Preservation Kitchen came out, more veteran cookbook author came up to me and was basically kind of implied that they were a little upset that their publisher had published a similar book. And I kind of thought, wait, these books have nothing in common. I mean, if anything, having more books around a theme can bring more interest to that category.
Absolutely.
And so, I just remember as a young author just being, oh, your Italian book got more attention than this Italian book, and thinking, I never even thought of that. I never even thought, I mean, if it's kind of like maybe if there's just budding interest in a particular category, everyone wins a little bit. So
yeah.
That's something that if you're writing this book, and maybe I'm just going to throw out a really crazy idea that I don't think is very marketable just for purposes of this discussion. Say you're doing a Koji fermented ice cream book that's the dairy-free answer to space food, and you find out somebody else is working on this book, and then you think, well, maybe if there's like growing interest, there's going to be more interest in this entire category, which could help all of us get book deals. I mean, think of Instant Pots, think of air fryers. There's certain subjects that the more books, the merrier. And if there is no market for this particular book because the subject is too narrow, then you don't ever have to worry about anyone stealing that idea. So just think of it a little bit more with the abundance mentality versus the scarcity mentality that Kristen always kind of talks about.
Yeah, just jump in the boat, get in the water. Everybody's going to rise. But what's important is producing good work.
Agree.
100%.
So here's an interesting question going back to one of our early episodes. The listener writes, in episode 2, you talk about how to choose an agent. Agents often say they want to be your partner in building your career as an author, but it feels like a chicken or egg process. My burning question, how do I get an agent or agent's attention? I'm starting to use connections for introductions and hope I can use my first book's success as well. But I haven't felt like the customer in the whole process.
Well, first off, congratulations on your first book success. That's huge.
Yeah, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it sounds like this person did that without an agent, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a big deal. I actually love the idea of getting introductions. I think referrals are in this business are valuable. And I think if you like know, if you have author friends who have an agent that they like, that is a good way to start introducing yourself to agents. But I guess in the end, it does go back to what Rika said, idea of voice platform. And so if one of those is not enough to get the attention of an agent, they need refining.
Yeah.
It could be the subject. One thing that surprised me early on in cookbook writing was that just because you had one book that came out that was a success didn't guarantee a second book deal that was bigger. That really surprised me. And I think that sometimes it really is. Maybe the second book ideal is just not as marketable. But the chicken and the egg thing is interesting because it's true. Like, how do you attract an agent? I think what Kristen says about referrals, asking friends who have an agent for an introduction is if that friend believes the work is a good fit for the agent. But I think for the individual, it's also worth asking. And this goes back to something Andrea said in an earlier episode of what do you want an agent for? What do you expect from the agent? And maybe you're expecting the world from an agent and an agent's thinking, well, I can't deliver you a world. I can deliver you potentially a deal, but it might not be the deal you're looking for. So it is matchmaking. The agent-author relationship is a lot of matchmaking. And, you know, if you're on the dating scene, it takes a while sometimes to find someone you like. And it's the same with the author and agents.
Agents are still looking. I mean, even though this person says they don't feel like the customer, which sounds like they just don't feel like they're getting the attention. But I always am surprised by how many more agents there are than I'm aware of. I mean, there's a lot and it's just finding the right one somehow.
If you've got a first book out and it's successful, then that is your calling card. Mm-hmm. You want to look for an agent who handles similar types of authors, similar kinds of books that that person would represent you well. You know, I go back to this notion of the word customer versus the word client. I think it's good to see yourself as a customer, but it's also good to see yourself as a client. I imagine like being an agent, it's a service. It's also sales, and there's a lot in there. And for this person, if they want to be part of the whole process, they can insert themselves. You know, it's not just the agent driving the bus. It's like you, the author, whether you consider yourself a customer or a client, you, the author, are also driving the bus with your ideas and your collaboration with the agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing to know, unless your platform is huge and like you yourself are the thing to be sold, agents want like concrete ideas that can sell. Their job is to sell something. So they're either selling you, the author, or your idea. You need to make what they're selling as easy as possible because they're very busy.
Well, and going back to Kristen's, you know, test out your idea. If you can show that you've gotten, you know, you're the top story on a particular popular website, an agent's going to be like, oh, well, that kind of tests out this idea a little bit. So you have stats, you have analytics to back it up.
Would it be true to say whether you work with an agent or not, you always need to have a lawyer? If you have an agent, is it still a good idea or necessary to have a lawyer look over contracts you may sign, either with the agent or the publisher? I mean, we can't give legal advice, that's for sure. But
to indemnify our podcast here.
Everything cookbooks, not everything legal advice.
But yeah, I mean, I know someone who instead of working with an agent, she will work with a lawyer. You have an agreement between yourself and your agent that you might want to have reviewed by a lawyer, but a lot of it comes down to trust, I would think.
Well, how comfortable you are reading and understanding and then negotiating if you feel the need. I mean, if you read a contract and it makes sense to you, when it comes down to your contract with your publisher, in my case, I trust my agent.
Agree.
To read.
I do too.
I've never gone next level with that contract. Now, Andrea, you don't have an agent or don't work with an agent.
But I'm comfortable reading legalese.
Yeah.
That goes back to my work in finance and as a bank examiner. So what a lawyer is really, 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 really good for is to spin out weird scenarios. They're going to spin out scenarios like, at what point may you, the author, be getting the short end of the stick? And in what kind of situation? They're going to throw that at you. And then you, as the author, have to think, how probable is that? And if you're really, really considered as being something that could happen, then you need to negotiate that. And then what kind of language, what kind of terms do you want? I would say, when you're starting out, perhaps with the first contract that you sign, whether that's with the agent or the publisher or through an agent with a publisher, if you don't understand exactly what the terms are, and if you're really detail-oriented, some of the little stuff, have a lawyer take a look at it so that you understand what your responsibilities are, so that you get some of that terminology down in your back pocket. So in the future, as your career hopefully evolves, you're going to be able to go back and go, oh yeah, I understand that. So there is some kind of through line for your personal understanding. You know, the agent's great. You got to trust your agent, sure. But at the end of the line, you have to trust yourself. And you can't always place 100% of everything into someone else's hands. For me, in the long term, I really don't have anybody but myself to blame for things that go wrong.
That's a fantastic answer. One thing I would add is, if you are somebody who owns a food business or a restaurant or something like that, you might already have a lawyer you work with, and you might want to have a lawyer involved also in any kind of agent negotiation or with an agreement with a publisher, just because there might be, trademark things with your brand or things like that, that the lawyer is there to look for, even if they're not a lawyer that specializes in publishing. So that's one thing that if you already work with a lawyer for your business, can't hurt. But I agree that you kind of want to trust your agent if you're working with them. And if you do have questions about what is in an agent author agreement, ask the agent. If you don't feel comfortable with those questions, it's probably not a good fit for you. If you're already sort of, oh, I don't feel good about this agreement and I want to ask these questions, but I'm worried that agent's not going to treat me very well if I question their judgment. So, and the final thing I'll add to that is, there in the literary world, there has been a lot of sort of like bad actors. And I don't think this has really affected cookbook world people. If I'm wrong on this, send us in some information on it. But I would just look forward to make sure that this is a legit agent. If there's an agent who is going to charge you for certain services, that's sort of a red flag. A standard agent author agreement is a 15% agreement. But in say, like if you're writing novels or nonfiction, there are agents out there that say, hey, pay me this money and I'll guarantee you a deal. Like, these are kind of scammy things to avoid. So ensure that if you're working with an agent, they have a track record, or they're working with people with track records if they're starting out.
Good tip.
To underscore what Andrea said, that, reading it yourself is, whether or not you're going to decide to work with a lawyer, but to take the responsibility to read it for yourself and understand it to the best of your ability. And if you don't, teach yourself to understand it, because you should know what you're signing. And then Authors Guild, we've mentioned it before, but Authors Guild is a good resource for authors that can provide legal, guidance and things like that too, that will help avoid some of what Kate is talking about, I think.
The scammers out there.
Hey.
All right. So I think we have time for one more question. This is a good one. So if you are trying to interview a couple of agents to see if they're a good fit for your cookbook, one, do you let them know up front that, you're talking to multiple agents? And two, how do you let them know you've picked someone else in the nicest way possible so that you don't burn your bridge? I think this is a terrific question. This is one of those questions that maybe you've got this amazing platform and you've got agents contacting you and they're like, I want to work with you because we think you're great. So then what do you do?
I have been through this, and I think the answer is yes. Full transparency. You are letting them know that you're considering two different roles. You're considering two different offers. You're considering, you do it in the nicest way possible, but it's a professional respect, I think, to say, this is what I'm doing. I'm interviewing different agents. I'm entertaining different offers or whatever, however the language you want to use it. But for me, the answer is quite simple. It's yes. And do it professionally and with respect.
Yeah. And I guess to piggyback on that, if you have a big platform and you start getting inquiries from agents, but you're not ready to write a book, something you can always do is say, I'm not yet ready to write a book, but when I am, I'd love to reach out. You'll probably continue getting inquiries. And then when you feel more ready, you can reach out to them all at once, interview them all at once, and then select somebody. especially if you like know you're on this mission, you want to build this platform, but so you don't feel pressured to sign necessarily with that first agent that comes to you, because chances are if one comes, more will as well.
Right. And agents are used to this. I mean, this is their life. It's just part of the business. They're used to having to, you know, sell their services and their ideas, as well as be able to pitch you to an editor. And if you talk to an agent and you don't think they're doing a very good job at on selling themselves, then you don't really want that. How are you going to believe that they're going to really sell your idea to an editor? And it's a personal thing too.
Right. It's a personal match. And if you're trying to like play this cloak and dagger thing and not tell one that you're talking to the other, and then they find out, that's going to burn a bridge more than...
Exactly. What's the point? You know, let people know that they got to compete for you. They have to show off what they've got. And so I would definitely let people know up front. And when it doesn't work out, you just say, you know what? Thank you so much. It just isn't the right situation for me at this moment, but I hope that we can work together in the future.
And that may not be a comfortable conversation, but it's the right one to have.
Agreed.
Whew, that's great. I love hearing from listeners.
Yeah. I know, so much good stuff.
Yeah.
So why don't we round up with a hot seat lightning round? What is it? Episode 16 of our little baby podcast. But how about if we reflect on key takeaways, either from our interviews and or just from each other?
I'll start. So no one takes my idea. No, I'm just kidding. I'll start. And this one goes back to, I believe it was the podcast we talked about, cookbook deals. One of the things that I am new to is the idea of morality clauses in contracts and sensitivity reads. So these are things that I'm learning about, and I really appreciated Kristen and Andrea talking and sharing about.
And one of the things that I've learned from the growth of Everything Cookbooks is that we're not alone. Space aliens will come down upon us. No, I joke around a lot, but I'm not joking about this. I think that so oftentimes we do work in our little silos as writers and as authors and editors too. And I have gotten so many nice comments from people who said, yeah, you know, this is a great resource for folks who are making cookbooks, wondering how this all happens. I've learned a lot because, you know, we don't plan these conversations that much. And so they're pretty extemporaneous in many regards. And the four of us are sharing information that sometimes I think come from the depths of our souls that we don't even know is really there. But as it comes out to the rest of the world, I think all the feedback and the growth of the listenership has just been so wonderful. It's beautiful the way that people have reacted positively. And I think that we keep learning from one another. And that bodes a lot of positivity for the future of the podcast, and also just for cookbook writing. I just want more and more good cookbooks out there.
Agree.
You know, so you need some advice and some help from your friends.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Love that.
Great answer.
I'll say it again. I mean, the thing, I feel like I've said it twice already on this episode, but I go back to what Rika said about voice, idea, platform. I just think it crystallizes so much of what will help you get a book published. And if one of those is not that strong and you're struggling with getting something published, you can take some time and be like, all right, what do I need to work on? I think the hardest thing to work on is actually probably not platform. It's probably voice, because it's like coming to terms with like, okay, I need to learn to write better. That's something I think about a lot ever since Rika said that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that one up. And it's funny, I was thinking about this going into this episode, and Andrea, I was leaning towards what you just said. And of course, going last, hosting is always the trickiest because you go last and you're like, oh, you took them all. I think one thing is I've learned that making a podcast with people that you really admire and respect is a ton of fun. But I am just back to our last episode, I think, with talking about to Diane Jacob about what's changed over, you know, the 30 some years I've been in this industry. And a lot has changed. But then again, a lot hasn't too. And it still, it just goes back to that voice and it goes back to solid recipe writing and solid writing. And, you know, I learned like the design stuff, the Michelle Tam, I keep thinking about that interview and about visual recipe writing and how she incorporates her family into it. And, you know, talking with Alice Chow about design and the, you know, the whole design forward thing is fascinating to me, but in the end, I just still come back to the strength of that voice. So, and lots more to come. So
yes.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for our first listener question episode. It was really fun.
Sure was.
Yeah. Keep the questions coming.
Right? Thank you for listening to Everything Cookbooks. As always, if you have a question you'd like us to answer, leave a voice message or send us a note through our website, everythingcookbooks.com. All of the books mentioned on the show can be found on our affiliate page at bookshop.org. And if you have a minute to spare, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Sincere thanks to our editor, Abby Circatella. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, keep on writing, reading, and cooking.